88.7. And thank you. And I hope that we can do this show again, because there's more to this. And I'll be inviting you guys on again. Thank you
all
for
right,
coming.
Thanks for
bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
My landlord's a wealthy man, living off rent like the fat of the land.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of Eviction Free 2016, a rally in March organized by Portland Tenants United. On January 15th at 4:30 p.m., tenants will gather at Portland City Hall to demand an end to no-cause evictions, landlord retaliation, and persistent discrimination against racial minorities. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Hello, neighbors, if you try to stop an eviction, I'd be by your side. Hello, neighbors, you know you should fight for a right for the common good.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight, I'll be airing audio from a performance that took place on October 18th, 2015, at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. The performance was called With You on the Journey. It was the culmination of a series of writing workshops for family members of people in prison. The performance included 10 family members and 11 monologues. These monologues told stories of having a loved one in prison. Tonight is part 3 of the performance, and it includes the 5th monologue. The entire performance is being aired in segments over the next few months on KBOO's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's monologue was written by a mother of a person with schizophrenia. After the monologue, I'll be speaking with a special guest, who is a local mental health advocate. We begin with Chris Karsmar introducing tonight's monologue.
Before we have intermission, we have one more story. Karen is also a mother, and she has written about the intense difficulties of trying to help a mentally ill family member who has become enmeshed with the criminal justice system.
Handcuffs, not healing, our shameful treatment of the mentally ill. My son is diagnosed with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, and although the 6 years he spent in prison saved his life, people with mental illness should not be confined to a jail or prison cell. My son had his first psychotic break at the age of 21. One minute we were discussing what's for dinner, and the next he was wild-eyed and screaming that the bitch next door planted a chip in his brain. I managed to get him to St. Vincent's Hospital. That was my introduction to schizophrenia. When my son was released in the same mental state, I was introduced to society's failure to help persons suffering from mental illness. Almost 15 years later, not much has changed in the treatment of persons with mental illness. Soon after returning home from the hospital, my son stopped taking the medications prescribed. He talked about living in the Matrix, the science fiction movie about simulated reality. He used methamphetamines and other drugs. He did not believe he was ill, and because he was an adult, I could only helplessly stand by and watch. He could be involuntarily treated only if he became an imminent danger to himself and to others. During the next years, my son lived with me, and I tried to help. I educated myself about mental illness and addiction. Al-Anon, a group for families of addicts, urged me to sever ties because while on meth, he could hurt me. The mental health group, NAMI, cautioned against throwing a mentally ill person out on the streets. As you can imagine, family dynamics are strained when a loved one is sick. As a parent, you learn a whole new set of parenting skills. Mental illness manifests in many behaviors that include such acts as petty theft, loitering, trespassing, urinating in public, shoplifting, and, since they are criminal in nature, these acts lead to jail and prison. My son was in and out of county jails for nonviolent misdemeanor crimes. In 2006, my son began to decompensate. Decompensation is the deterioration of a person's mental state that can occur when a person does not receive or refuses proper or adequate treatment. He had a good job and even had his own apartment, but his life began to unravel. As you watch a loved one's mental state deteriorate, reality prevails over anticipation of a hopeful outcome. The reality was, he's hospitalized, in jail, or dead. So I expected the phone call I received saying my son committed armed robbery, a Measure 11 crime, and if found guilty, he would serve a 70-month sentence in prison. He used a BB gun in the robbery. Not only was my son decompensating or losing control of his mental state when he committed this crime, but he suffered from anosognosia, which means that a person is genuinely unable to recognize that a mental health problem exists. These key words associated with mental illness, decompensation and anosognosia, are two main reasons why many people are locked in our jails and prisons. My son was sentenced under Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law, Measure 11, and sent to Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution in Pendleton to begin his six-year sentence. Though gravely disabled, his mental state was not considered, and again, I could only helplessly stand by and watch. The Oregon Department of Corrections is mandated by law to treat people with mental illness, yet it is ill-equipped to adequately treat the increasing numbers of persons with special needs. The statistics vary, but more than half of those in custody have some form of mental or emotional disorder, and many also have an addiction. Many are not criminals, but they land in our prisons and county jails because adequate treatment is not available in our communities. How did we get to this place? Until the 1950s, people with mental illness were warehoused in psychiatric hospitals. Outrage over these cruel conditions led to the closing of these hospitals with the promise to provide more humane care for the mentally ill in our communities. That promise was never kept. Instead, deinstitutionalization and severe punishment for drug users in recent decades shifted the burden of care for addiction and mental illness to jails and prisons. The explosion in the prison population is a direct result of the United States' failure to treat mental illness and addiction as medical conditions. After about 4 years into his prison sentence, my son was transferred to the mental health infirmary at the state penitentiary in Salem. My first visit to the penitentiary left me with nightmares. I was led to a large room where my son, looking like a madman, sat in a small steel cage, head on his chest, staring vacantly. He did not utter a word. I was chastised for touching his hand through the steel bars. To see him, one would probably wonder what vicious crime was committed that brought him to this place. Yet, as his mother, I knew who he was. A wonderful, talented, and gifted student, someone who loved life and learning, someone with a promising future. Someone whose unusual teenage defiance should have been recognized as an advancing illness. I said that prison saved my son's life, but he received help only due to my relentless vigilance and advocacy during his 6 years in prison. 2 months after his transfer to the penitentiary, the state chief psychiatrist spoke with me, after which he immediately diagnosed my son and proceeded with involuntary treatment. Involuntary treatment meant that the prison guards in black riot gear held down my son and injected him with medication. How frightening must that be for a person already disorganized and delusional? I was hopeful that this was the beginning of recovery toward well-being. But is this how we should get people the treatment they need? What is prison like for a person experiencing symptoms of mental illness? Often a person does not admit to their mental illness because of the associated stigma. They are often preyed upon and much more likely to be injured in a fight. They have trouble following prison rules and are placed in disciplinary segregation, solitary confinement for minor infractions. My son was repeatedly placed in solitary confinement for not signing in before he took a shower. Many studies show that isolation exacerbates a mentally ill condition. The United Nations calls 15 days of solitary confinement torture. My son served his 6 mandatory years with 3 more years of community parole, which mandated mental health treatment and medication. But when his parole ended in 2014, he stopped all mental health treatment, including taking an antipsychotic medication. Once again, he began to decompensate, spiraling out of control. I alerted his psychiatrist, his parole officer, crisis intervention, his mental health case manager, and the police. No one would help. When he urinated in public, the police were called, he was arrested and incarcerated in the county jail. All my involvement through my son's self-destructive early years, through his 6-year prison term, and during the years since his prison release did not prepare me for his experience in the county jail. From clueless attorneys to demeaning jail medical staff to their special units, the experience was appalling and inconceivable. HIPAA, laws in place to protect a person's privacy, were used as a convenient excuse to not provide help. My son sat locked alone and unresponsive in a cell for up to 24 hours each day. He refused to meet with his attorney or attend his court hearings. Because he did not sign the proper forms, I could not visit or speak with him, and the medical staff could not inform me of his health or mental state. He was not administered medication while in the jail. As weeks went by, then months, I could not believe the callousness with which my concerns were met. What irreparable brain damage will my son experience due to this long-term isolation, this torture by United Nations standards? Why couldn't someone reach out and convince my son to sign whatever damn paper was required to get the help he needed? Once again, I helplessly stood by. 4 months later, After the court found my son unable to assist in his own defense, he was sent to the Oregon State Hospital in Salem. The Oregon State Hospital treats a person only to legal competency, so, though not fully restored to wellness, he was nevertheless returned to the county jail to face prosecution. He was placed on 1 year probation with the condition that he take his medication. He was released from jail, but after this 7-month ordeal that originated with urinating in public, my son lost his housing, his disability benefits stopped, his food stamps ended, his Oregon health plan insurance benefits suspended, his Oregon ID, Social Security card, and bus pass all needed to be replaced. This is where a family member or friend steps in to help piece together some semblance of a life. Will my son go back to jail? As long as society continues to criminalize his behaviors over which he has no control, as long as we lack the moral obligation or the will to properly and adequately care for persons suffering from mental illness, as long as the first responders in a mental health crisis lead a person to jail instead of to treatment, without these changes, he will. And once again, I'll helplessly stand by.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We just heard a monologue entitled Handcuffs Not Healing, Our Shameful Treatment of the Mentally Ill. I'm joined by a special guest who is a mental health advocate locally, and she's been a volunteer with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, since 2005. She's been a NAMI family-to-family teacher since 2007, a NAMI support group facilitator since 2010, and she's also a member of the Reentry and Mental Health Action Team since 2011, as well as part of the Crisis Intervention Team International since 2011. Welcome to Prison Pipeline. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Good to be here, Amy.
After listening to Karen's monologue, is there a place you'd like to start with?
Well, definitely we need more services instead of incarcerating people. We need more services in the community. Something similar to the PSRB,
what's
Psychiatric
PSRB?
Security Review Board. Then they would be helped and monitored. They would need to take their medications. It's like assisted outpatient treatment. They would, and mental health court, they would need to take their medications instead of just, okay, I'm done with this, I'm going off my medicine, which leads to more decompensation. Also, I think they need to have pharmacogenetic testing because that will show the pathways they have in their liver and show which medicines are more likely to work for them and which ones are going to build up in their system over time and give them severe side effects.
Mm.
So if we can get them to stay on the medication better because they're experiencing less side effects, then you're going to see a lot more people recovering.
The mental health courts, that's if a person's involved criminally, and then the other alternative is the psychiatric review board. Could you explain a little bit about what those two are?
The psychiatric security review board is when someone has pleaded not guilty except for insanity. And sometimes the Psychiatric Security Review Board will accept them into their program. And some of those people do end up in the state hospital, and some do not. And some will get placed into community sooner than others. They're very careful, and they monitor the people carefully. And they have a very low recidivism rate. So it's a very successful program.
for people who do have a loved one who is incarcerated and has a mental illness, Karen, in her monologue, mentioned how she had to relentlessly advocate for her son. And even the example she talked about with him not signing in for the showers, that only stopped being a problem when she called and she talked to the person who was in charge of disciplinary segregation and explained that her son had a mental illness. Is there some advice you could give to family members who have someone in prison about how to advocate for their loved one?
Do not give up. Keep calling. Keep reaching out. Email and call. Just do not give up, because somebody will eventually help you. You're going to find a good person with a heart out there somewhere. In one person's situation, they talked to the senator, they talked to the public defender, and the jail personnel. Nobody was helping them. Finally, they talked to the sheriff, and nothing flat, they were helped. So there was somebody that finally came through for them. So just do not give up. Even if this is taking months, keep trying. Always ask the jails and prisons to ask your family member to sign a release of information form so they can talk to you, because oftentimes they won't communicate with you and tell you how your loved one is doing if there is not a signed ROI, release of information. And these do expire, so pay attention to when they're going to expire and ask for them to sign them again before they expire. Some are 6 months, some are a year.
Could you tell us about the Reentry and Mental Health Action Team? What kind of actions you guys have been doing, and also how people can get involved if they'd like to be part of that group?
We've attended some meetings. We've done some tours, and we've written a lot of letters. Our meetings are the fourth Tuesday every month, 6:30 to 8:30, at Aloha at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Station on Blanton Street. We've written to some senators, some attorneys. We've written to all the sheriffs in the state, asking them to put a mental health response to how a person can advocate for someone with mental illness that's in jail on each sheriff's website. And Sheriff Pat Garrett has put one on with Washington County. One of the best ones that I send to a lot of people is the one with LA County. You can Google it, and it's LA County Mental Health Response, and they show the steps that you can take. The sheriff is like the head person of the jail, even though there really is a director of the jail. The sheriff gets to say how things really happen. One of the things we're doing with the Reentry and Mental Health Action Team is we're putting out a guide for families and friends and advocates to help plan and provide a continuum of care. And it will have a lot of definitions, DOC coding, organizations and groups, and a checklist of what things you need to do when someone's releasing from prison. So it'll start out with what to do if they're releasing in 9 months, and then in 6, 5, 3, and 1 to 2. There are so many items that need taken care of that if a person has mental health issues and they don't have an advocate, then they're not going to be able to get out and function. They need help, and that help is not very available because so many workers have such high caseloads. So it would be nice if there was more funding and more workers to help people, because not everyone will even allow a family member to advocate for them. It's part of the illness sometimes is they are very against their family.
And where would people be able to get the brochure once it's published?
We're going to have that online, and you can email us even at remaction@gmail.com.
Great, and that's the Reentry and Mental Health Action Team.
We're involved with crisis intervention team training that helps police officers recognize when somebody is having mental health symptoms and act accordingly. There's different things that they will not do that they would do with somebody who is truly a criminal. The person with developmental disabilities or mental health issues, a police officer or law enforcement officer is going to have to be more subdued and careful not to make the person escalate so their symptoms don't escalate.
I knew that that's something that Portland was supposed to be moving more towards, having these crisis intervention teams after the killing of James Chassie.
Also, we want the officers to be safe. Sometimes the officers get shot, and we don't want any more of that happening. So we want them to be able to recognize when someone's having a mental health crisis, and they need to get back, give the person more space. Sometimes they just need to take cover, too. Stephen Dodds, for instance, he was wounded very badly over by the coast, and Chris Burley here in the Portland area. So it's not just, let's protect the person with mental illness with the officers. Let's protect the officers, too. This type of training is win-win for both sides. I've talked to quite a few officers, and they're very glad they've taken the training, and they say it helps them a lot with dealing with people with mental illness. One of the exercises that's done in the training is what it's like for somebody that's hearing voices. Some of the voices that people hear can be very negative, and they come with moods. It's very controlling for the person. If the voices are telling them bad things about the officer, this person believes that, and they get very paranoid, and it's very dangerous. It's especially important how they breathe, too. The way they breathe can help the person with mental illness be calmer.
For someone who has a family member who has mental illness, or even a friend who has mental illness, is there any advice that you would give to them and or to the general public as how to be a better support person for people who have mental illness?
I would tell them to learn about pharmacogenetics and to read I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help by Xavier Amador. And if they have any crisis, when they do call the police, to always ask for a CIT-trained officer.
And crisis intervention.
Yes. If they get the response, and this is what many hear, if they get the response, oh, all our officers are CIT-trained, then say, I need an officer that has 40-hour CIT training. Because, yes, they all get some CIT training, but they don't all have the 40-hour CIT training. And there is advanced directives that people can do that will help them to have the doctors know what kind of treatment they are fine with.
What is the advanced directive?
With the Mental Health Crisis Advanced Directive, it's pretty lengthy. They can put what kinds of medicines have worked for them in the past and what kinds have not, what kind of treatments they would be all right with. And some even do, I believe, what is called a Ulysses contract that says, even if I'm trying to say, no, I don't want help, pay attention to the advanced directives and do it anyway, because a lot of advanced directives can be revoked, and they can revoke them while they're not doing well. Karen mentioned anosognosia. Another pronunciation is anosognosia. You'll hear it both ways. It means the same thing. The person has no insight. They don't know that they are ill. And Xavier Amador, in his book, I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help, covers that very well. He has had a brother who had schizophrenia, and he's also a psychologist, so he's very knowledgeable in this, and he's helped with a lot of CIT trainings. In the advanced directive, they will pick a couple people who will act as an advocate for them if they are incapacitated, and they should give it to their case manager. The mental health agency that they're connected with should have it, and the hospital, if they have written which hospital they choose to go to if they're in crisis, and it needs to be notarized. So they need to have witnesses. It's very official. If they have anosognosia, it will be very difficult to get them to do a crisis advanced directive. It's called Mental Health Crisis Advanced Directive, and each state has their own.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. I've added links to the show pages for part 1 and part 2 of this performance on the webpage for tonight's performance. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. I want to thank Carol Imani for organizing With You on the Journey, Director Chris Karsmar, Assistant Director Melissa Schmitz, and all the participants of With You on the Journey. Stay connected to With You on the Journey at facebook.com/withyouonthejourney, which is all one word. I'd also like to thank my special guest for tonight's show. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
My landlord's a wealthy man, a living off rent like the fat of the land.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of Eviction Free 2016, a rally and march organized by Portland Tenants United. On January 15th at 4:30 p.m., tenants will gather at Portland City Hall to demand an end to no-cause evictions, landlord retaliation, and persistent discrimination against racial minorities. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Hello, neighbors, if you try to stop an eviction, I'd be by your side. Hello, neighbors, you know you should fight for a right for the common good.
You got it on KBOO Portland. Keep it locked for Hard Knock Radio.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, oh.
It's history.